Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we'll be having a conversation with Duke Clinical Research Fellow Dr. Paul Clark about overcoming barriers to care for hepatitis C, something we've talked about a lot and there's increasing national conversations on. Looking forward to that conversation.
I am as well. We have much to learn about hepatitis C, but first we're going to talk about some research that matters. We'll be talking about sinus infections and videos for preschoolers.
And those are not the same thing.
No,
those are two different research. We don't want you to have a sinus infection and then watch a video, but two different elements there and whether or not steroids help with those sinus infections. And then about, does it matter if you are obese or not in terms of getting colon cancer screening?
And finally, is watching late night TV and being on the computer linked with depression?
If so, we may have a few problems for lots of us. Uh-oh. Well, let's talk about the very first research, which is about this colon cancer screening in physical activity among people who are obese. And I guess it's an interesting question, Christy, but are people who are obese less likely to get colon cancer screening?
Well, so we know that obese women are at higher risk for several cancers, but yet they're less likely than other women to engage in the regular prevention screening, getting their colorectal screening and getting good enough physical activity.
And I imagine it would be obese men, too, might be less likely to get colon cancer screening. I don't necessarily know it'd be just linked to women. And I wonder sometimes if it's due to physicians' biases and perhaps recommending those cancer screenings, because they know it's going to be a more difficult screening test. It's not like it's just in and out of the gastroenterology office, perhaps with someone who's thinner.
I also wonder if obese women may be less likely to go for their regular prevention because they know the doctor's going to tell them to lose weight and maybe they aren't ready to hear it. I don't know, but this is a question.
And men, too. I think it'll happen in men. But let's
probably
talk about
true.
This particular research, which was 180 women. This was in the Journal of Health Communication, and they looked at ways of increase in colorectal cancer screening or colonoscopies with these women.
And they were trying to find out if targeted health messages...
Like what?
Like sending something saying, hey, why don't you exercise today? Those sorts of targeted messages might improve women, obese women versus regular weight women seeking prevention strategies and also exercising.
Right. So will they go and get their colon cancer screening, but also maybe increase their exercise patterns? And I guess the results showed that these targeted messages were something that were well received, but they didn't necessarily increase their overall exercise patterns, but they were well received in terms of getting their colon cancer screening.
And they did find that exercise intentions or the intention to exercise more did increase more among the inactive obese women who received those messages compared with the ones who were in the control group and did not receive those messages. Hard to say did they actually exercise more, but they certainly intended to.
Yeah, and I guess there's a bottom line take-home message, which is, you know, everyone has unique barriers and reasons why they do or don't get screening test or really any intervention in medicine. And should we tailor it not just for people, obese women or actually obese men, but should we tailor what we say to anyone's particular health needs? And I think it was an over-resounding yes.
And I think it's exciting that we're using different technology and different ways to outreach to people. And this is just another step in that understanding of which groups of people respond to that best and where we can really make a difference.
Right. I guess the only hesitation I have is let's not assume that we know why certain groups of people might get certain screening tests. So we think, oh, if we do something just like this, women or men who are obese will go in here. I think we have to really understand more what people's reasons for getting it and why they're scared, and then we target it to that.
Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about the next one, which is whether or not taking steroids by mouth, or those oral steroids that help with inflammation, help clear up sinus infections.
Yes, this research, Christy, in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, our colleagues up north, looked at 174 patients who'd come to see their doctors who had things that sounded like a condition like sinusitis, and they were either given 30 milligrams of prednisone a day or those placebo pills, and followed up after a week of taking these. And I thought this was really interesting. I would have thought that it would have shown benefit to the prednisone group.
I would have thought so, too. And it's disappointing, of course, because we know antibiotics have been shown to not make a difference.
In most cases.
In most cases. And we know that the steroids, the sprays by nose, have been shown to make a small difference by getting relief a couple days sooner.
Yeah, so like the, 1 out of 15 people who take them get some benefit. Hope. A small difference, right?
Better than antibiotics. So this really had some promise. But what they found was that there was really no difference in improvement of symptoms after a week.
Yeah, so I think the bottom line here is if you have sinus infection, talk with your doctor. And if they suggest perhaps steroids, maybe ask them, well, what about this latest research that shows there's no benefit of steroids? Because you shouldn't take them if it doesn't provide you benefit.
There are a lot of side effects.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters, which is problems with our teens and our preteens with sleep, maybe even adults with sleep, and what they're watching during the day in terms of TV.
I have to say this hits home for me, Adam. I heard this research the other morning right after a night that was a reasonable sleep for my children, but I let them watch Star Wars, the original Star Wars, the night before. And then I heard this and thought, probably not the best idea.
Yeah, if you're in touch with their dreams and EEGs on the pediatrics side, you would have seen some very strange patterns.
Exactly. Okay, so this is in the Journal of Pediatrics, and they looked at 565 children and their families, randomly divided into two groups. And in one group, they encouraged the parents to change their kids' viewing habits over 6 months by substituting what they called healthy media, like Dora the Explorer, Sesame Street, and Curious George, all of children in the ages of 3 to 5 years.
Right. And I wouldn't call those completely violent three. I've watched Sesame Street. There's a lot of hitting going on sometimes, but not compared to a lot of the videos that
say
Star Wars or Harry Potter or lots of zapping going on that's kind of scary. And they found that those that were watching the healthy media had better sleep patterns.
They did, and they tracked it over time at the very beginning, and then at 6 months, 12 months, 18 months later, and did show a significant improvement in the group who changed their media habits, and really not very much change in the people who didn't get that advice. But at about 18 months, it started to creep back up again.
And we should be honest that it was statistically significant. The 6 or so percentage points difference may not be clinically significant, and that's up to our listeners and maybe doctors and having this conversation. But the question is, is there a downside to this?
Well, I would say no, and I would also argue that one parent getting one night of better sleep for a lot of people, they would consider that significant. But the recommendations for changing sleep, I mean, it's to be thoughtful about what is appropriate for your children based on their age and their emotional maturity, about ending screen time before going to bed, to be consistent about wake and sleep times, and just sort of thinking about sleep hygiene.
Well, I think, Christy, that we should be extending this actually to all, not just preschoolers, but I think this is relevant for teenagers and adults. If you're watching Law and Order right before you go to bed, and you're watching and you're playing violent video games right before you go to bed, I suspect there are more sleep problems in that group. And so I think we're going to hear more about this, and I think it's an important research.
I do too.
Let's put our very last one real briefly.
Also about what you do before you go to bed, and this is a study in hamsters, but looking at
hamsters.
That's
okay,
right.
Okay, we don't report too much hamster research here. But
we don't. They expose them to dim light at night and watched them over a period of time and picked up changes in behavior that in the brain and certain measures that were similar to depression in adults.
and this was in the journal Molecular Psychiatry, appropriately enough, and those that hamsters that had the dim light at night produce more of a protein called tumor necrosis factor, and potentially showing this association, perhaps they think, in people between this chronic inflammation and depression. I do think this is a leap, but I think it's potentially important research.
Well, and I liked that they found that when you reversed it, that those changes went away. So if they stopped doing the dim light and computer type things for hamsters at night, it got better.
Right. Well, we do have research that matters for hamster health and maybe linked to humans. We've had a chance to talk about this. Nonviolent videos, perhaps better for all of us before we go to bed.
That oral steroids do not clear up sinus infections. And finally, that colorectal cancer screening and physical activity is important to promote for all people, and that targeted messages might make a difference.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Christy. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll talk about chronic care for hepatitis C, overcoming barriers, with physician and Duke Clinical Research Fellow, Dr. Paul Clark. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, I'm going to have an opportunity to have a really interesting conversation with Dr. Paul Clark, a hepatologist and currently a research fellow at the Duke Clinical Research Institute, about overcoming barriers to care for hepatitis C. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Clark.
Thanks very much for having me on.
You know, and Dr. Clark, I read this article. Let's tell our listeners right off the bat. You just had a really important article in the New England Journal of Medicine about hepatitis C. And I got to ask, what made you want to write an article that would be read by the most prestigious journal in the world?
It's a fascinating time, Adam, in hepatitis C at the moment. We're really the therapeutic advances are really marching on. It's a great time. If there is ever a good time to have hepatitis C, it's certainly now. Things are improving and have improved and are likely to continue to get much better for patients in terms of their likelihood of response, and the treatments will probably be a bit kinder to them in the future. But at the same time, in the context of all that, there's still a lot of barriers for patients who have hepatitis C on a sort of population health level. And I guess that's what motivated me to try and sort of cast a little bit more caution into the sort of general optimism that we have about hepatitis C.
Well, you're a hepatologist. And for our listeners, we should define you were trained in Australia.
That's right, yeah.
And tell us what a hepatologist, just real briefly, what does a hepatologist do?
Okay, well, the training program in America is similar to the training program in Australia. We do a subspecialty program looking after patients with liver disease. That includes patients with hepatitis C and the viral hepatitis B and C, which are...
And even hepatitis A, kind of the foodborne, patients.
And we might see them, and we might consult on them. And also all other causes of liver disease. Typically, we also train in gastroenterology as well, as I've done. Physicians might subspecialize later on. That includes diseases of the gut, the stomach, and the bowel, colonoscopy and endoscopy, the procedures that might be done for those.
So when I was coming through medical school, and I know Christy had the same training, we were trained a lot in hepatitis B, and that was the model. And we all got immunized against hepatitis B, and we uh-huh. occupational transmission. But we didn't hear a whole lot about hepatitis C, and it only seems to be in the last 3 to 5 years that hepatitis C has become sexy, as I would say. Why is it sexy?
Okay.
Or is it? Maybe you don't think it is, but I think it is. I mean, it's in New England Journal of Medicine.
It's certainly. I think it could be a bit sexier, to be honest, in the sense of it's a highly stigmatized disease. It shares
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's a disease that the Department of Health and Human Services here in the US called it a silent epidemic, and there's a lot of reasons that sort of conspire for that. Typically, hepatitis C is contracted via through the blood. That's really the way you contract hepatitis C. And for a vast majority of patients with hepatitis C, that's usually has been in the United States, was usually somewhere between the 1960s to the 1980s, often through intravenous drug use, or in the 1960s before the universal screening of blood products through transfusion of infected blood or blood products. So there's quite a bit of stigma because people associate that with the same stigma people had with HIV, that this is a sort of a shameful infection or sometimes patients now who might be presenting in their 50s or their 60s, having been infected in their 20s, really don't equate themselves. They might be successful people in the community, business people, mums, dads with kids, and coming with a diagnosis of hepatitis C has a sort of a bit of baggage attached to it, and they don't often associate the person they are now with the person they were when they were infected. So. So getting past that stigma is really important. It's important that programs like your own here to get the message out about this is just a virus. It's a virus. Whatever way you got it, it's treatable. And it's really important that we recognize it's just another infection that we need to deal with.
Well, we say it's just another infection, but in some respect, it's not. And in your article, you talk about four kinds of, recommendations or barriers from a major Institute of Medicine report that we really need to work on. You talked about lack of knowledge and awareness of healthcare providers among those who actually are at risk for an infection, among policymakers, and then the public. And so I guess we're maybe doing the public thing today.
That's right.
Trying to bring this home. But talk about this lack of knowledge and awareness about the healthcare providers, those who are at risk, and among policymakers.
Okay. Well, I think as you recognize there yourself, it's really probably only gained a bit of profile, hepatitis C, in the last few years, and you're a physician and you haven't really been terribly aware of it. I think bringing it into the radar of physicians in family practice is probably one of the more important from a healthcare provision point of view, but also other people who might be involved in the healthcare setting, practice nurses, even allied health people. These are the people who will see the front line cases of hepatitis C or perhaps be aware of the risk that a patient might bring. And the patient really mightn't be presenting with any particular symptoms. It might require that sort of second thought, to think about the possibility that the patient might have hepatitis C and to instigate that discussion. Often, as I said, because of the stigma, patients won't produce the sort of information that you might expect them to.
A 65-year-old gentleman who I may have cared for 5 or 10 years, and maybe I wouldn't have thought 20, 30 years ago risk factors that he might have been involved in, right? I would have to be
That's right.
Is a hard conversation to think about.
That's right. And it might be worth just talking about one of the difficulties in hepatitis C is that it's typically an infection that was acquired 20 years ago, and we usually only see the problems from hepatitis C 20 or 30 years later.
Like what?
So inflammation, hepatitis is Latin really for inflammation of the liver, and this inflammation causes liver injury, and cells in the liver die, and then other cells try to repair those, and as they do it, just like you'd have a scar on your arm from a scratch of the skin, so too does the liver get scarred, and this scarring and fibrosis leads to a condition we call cirrhosis, which is when the liver's scarred, you lose the important sponge-like liver tissue that can provide vitamins and proteins and also synthesize drugs and things like that. So you lose the function, both the synthetic function and the filtration function of the liver. Now, this is the problem of chronic liver disease, that the hepatitis C, which may have been infected 20 or 30 years ago, now is producing the problem 20 or 30 years later with chronic liver disease, cirrhosis. And so the presenting symptoms that a patient might have might be the loss of the the synthetic function of the liver, which is low protein. So patients can sometimes get ascites, that's fluid in the tummy, swelling of the ankles, in the swelling of the belly is ascites. Sometimes if the liver's really not working properly, they might get yellowing of the eyes called...
Well, they basically go into liver failure and jaundice, the yellowing
jaundice,
of the eyes,
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And there's other manifestations of that, including a sort of loss of thinking ability. We call that hepatic encephalopathy, where your thinking is a bit muddled sometimes. And probably most importantly, this sponge-like liver that has about 25% of the blood flow through it at any period of time, any minute, when it gets scarred up, the blood flow through it gets much, much higher pressure. We call that portal hypertension. It's like when the 15501 gets blocked and you're trying to get between Duke and UNC to see the Blue Devils take on the Tar Heels, then you have to go through the 751, and that is really not designed for high flow traffic. So just in the same way the blood flow gets blocked up in the liver, these small blood vessels that line the esophagus get dilated, and these are like varicose veins in the leg, and they get blown up, and they're at a severe risk of bleeding. And so one of our really big concerning complications of hepatitis C is esophageal varices, these big varicose veins in the esophagus, and they can bleed, and that's one of the major causes of illness and death to our liver disease patients.
So you now have even this family doctor sufficiently scared of hepatitis C.
Oh, good. That's my intention.
and I suspect a lot of people and our listeners, you know, they would now respect this as they would hepatitis. I think that term people generally know is not a good thing. And before we're going to have to do a break in a second, but help me understand. I can understand now better the need for this awareness of practitioners and in the public. What about policymakers? Help me understand why the policymakers and what you're hoping from your article.
Mm. So, I mean, the real trick and the challenge for the American healthcare system is to unite all these different parts of the puzzle of trying to care for people with hepatitis C. We need to make practitioners and people in the community more aware of the disease. We need to be able to find those people with the disease. We need active screening programs to find the people who have the disease.
But what would you, the policymaker, the legislators who are in the state legislators and the federal legislators, the people who are making decisions about funding, are you hoping to stimulate them to do more funding for research, treatment? I mean, because it would appear that in some respects we need to ramp up what we're spending in order to better care for these patients.
Absolutely. It's not only about spending, but it's about spending things more wisely. It's about not spending in one particular point, like on these more expensive drugs. These will be more expensive. There will be more cost for these drugs. But it's also about sharing that cost throughout more or less sexy parts of the healthcare system, which is things like vaccinating people with chronic hepatitis C for hepatitis B, things like high-risk groups, screening for infection among those, and clinics in low socioeconomic groups so that we can offer treatment to people who are most at risk and most vulnerable for the complications of the disease.
Well, we're going to actually, when we come back, we're going to talk about screening and we're going to talk about treatments and what we can ultimately kind of aspire to. We're talking with Dr. Paul Clark, a hepatologist and currently a research fellow at the Duke Clinical Research Institute. We're going to take a break, but we'll be right back with your health and conversations. Please stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. This week on Conversations, I'm continuing our conversation with Dr. Paul Clark, a hepatologist and currently a research fellow at the Duke Clinical Research Institute, about his article in the New England Journal of Medicine about overcoming barriers to care for hepatitis C. And Dr. Clark, I guess one of the questions that comes to mind, because in the article you really outline in a nice chart about the numbers of people who are getting treated every year with this in the United States, and it's you know, between 75,000 and 125,000 people a year. This is a major issue.
You know, what's really a major issue, Adam, is it's about 3.2 million people with hepatitis C, and that's a small fraction of the real caseload of hepatitis C.
And what percentage of that actually gets treatment or should be getting treatment?
Well, that's not a black and white answer. Unfortunately, that's a it's a more difficult question to give you a difficult question to answer in a simple one liner, but certainly much more than 100,000 people. I think the new drugs that we were talking about in the first half of the show, they're probably going to increase the number of people treated, but not by the sort of scale to really assail that big problem of 3.2 million people.
Well, currently there is a kind of a standard treatment that people, I don't know across the world, but I think in the United States they would think about this interferon along with this drug called ribavirin. And is that kind of the standard today? And that's expensive.
That's right.
And it has side effects.
Sure it is. It's really the backbone of treatment, and it remains the backbone of treatment. I think we're probably hoping in the next sort of 5 to 10 years that we might be free of this backbone of treatment, because it's a pretty arduous therapy for genotype 1, the most common hepatitis genotype in the United States. It's about 48 weeks of treatment with pegylated interferon and ribavirin. That's pretty tough. It's renowned for its flu-like symptoms, which is really nearly a year feeling like you've got the flu, but other more serious side effects such as anemia and rash, neutropenia, the drop of the white blood cells as well.
And I've read up to 80 to 90% of people will have some side effects, which to me sounds like, okay, we have a drug that possibly can prevent this cirrhosis or the scarring and the cancer that could come about it, maybe even cure your system, but it's almost like a chemotherapeutic drug-like of effect. It has serious side effects.
Absolutely. It's an immune modulator. So everything that you get when you're having the flu, you know, the fevers and the feeling miserable, that's what it's designed to encourage. And that's where the new drugs, these direct-acting antivirals, which have been available in the United States for over 12 months now, that's where the excitement for these drugs comes in, because they target the virus rather than trying to stimulate the immune system as the interferon does. They try and stimulate, they try and target the virus directly. And that's the attractive. That's the new face of hepatitis C treatment. Hopefully we'll be able to leave the history of hepatitis C with pegylated interferon behind us. But right now we need that as well. In the next 5 to 10 years, as I say, we might be able to move away from that completely.
Well, talk about, just for one second, you mentioned genotyping. And I think that's actually a new advance that wasn't there 5 and 10 years ago. And that before someone gets a treatment, that you do recommend they get this genotype. And describe what it is and why that's recommended now.
Sure. So there's a couple of important points. There's two sorts of things here. We're talking about a person who's infected and a virus that's infecting them. So the virus itself has, there's several genotypes. The major ones are 1 to 4.
The genotypes are the
genetic
the DNA of the
right.
virus.
That's right. Well, the hepatitis C is an RNA virus. Actually, there is no DNA. It relies on the host to make itself. And there is the most dominant genotype in the United States is genotype 1, and that's a bit harder to treat. It takes 48 weeks of treatment. If you're infected with genotypes 2 and 3, which are more common in Asia and Asian communities, that's half the length of treatment for those genotypes. Now, as well as the viral genotype, there's also the host genotype. So we know that certain patients have a genetic tendency to do better with this pegylated interferon and ribavirin. And this is a discovery, amongst others, came out of North Carolina in a genome-wide association study performed at Duke and collaborated with many, many groups. And that showed that this IL-28B genotype was strongly associated, the strongest predictor of viral response to this treatment. And so we put a few of these things together. It may well be that IL-28B genotype, as these new drugs come along, becomes a sort of not irrelevant, but perhaps much less relevant. But we use that in conjunction with a few other things to help us try and get a sense of what the patient's likelihood of responding to treatment is.
That's clearly an important factor in this, and perhaps a team-based approach from the public health system to the primary doctor to the hepatologist to help understand what needs to be done, I guess, for patients. And we got so much that we could cover, but I think we actually have to cover this. What I didn't really appreciate was perhaps controversial. Even in your article, it doesn't really talk about it as controversial, but screening.
Uh-huh.
And talk about that, because it appears to me, just from what you said before, if there's 3 million people who have it and only 100,000 getting treated, even with the bad or the more toxic drug, there's still hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, who in the U.S. alone, who don't know they even have it. So there is some recommendations for screening, but those are somewhat controversial.
Well, that's right. I think The screening recommendations currently are based on the risk, so patients who are at risk of getting having hepatitis C, and those are really people who have a history of injection drug use, of being incarcerated, a history of blood transfusion products before 1989, before screening came in for blood products. So that was the sort of targeted. You really had to be thinking about it as a primary care physician. You had to be thinking about that patient. But
when you go into a, I don't think, but maybe I'm wrong, that when prisoners get incarcerated, do they routinely get checked for hepatitis C now?
No, not routinely, no.
And why is that?
Well, I think that this is part of the sort of public health failings, I think, that really, you know, knowing that it's a high-risk environment should mandate checking on the way out, so that at least when patients are released from prison, they know their risks, and when they go back to their loved ones, they can consider the risks of transmission. I think the important question is really how we would address that in a holistic way, and without seeing screening as part of treatment and treatment as part of prevention, then you know you tend to lose one of those parts of a really an important process, a circle of things rather than one thing on its own.
Well, and I do know that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, kind of the gold bible for a lot of primary care docs, recommends against screening, in part, I guess, because maybe there isn't enough good treatments, or you have to do liver biopsies and a lot of and all this kind of controversy around the potential side effects. But uh-huh. I guess if we had better treatments, maybe there would be less resistance to screening.
Sure, and I think that comes into the context now that the CDC has really put some draft guidelines now, and anyone born between 1945 and 1965 is likely to be recommended. This is a birth cohort approach to screening. So anyone in that sort of baby boomer population for primary care physicians should be screened for hepatitis C, or at least the CDC's got draft guidelines. That'll sort of move in a geological timescale. But eventually, I think everyone accepts that they're the group that are really mainly at risk for the complications of hepatitis C.
And if you have a blood test for the hepatitis C, or perhaps you went into your primary care doctor and you had a liver test for some reason, and uh-huh. the liver test was abnormal,
yep.
that should also probably be a red flag.
Absolutely. It doesn't preclude the normal sort of thinking about the risk for a patient if they're outside that birth cohort. And certainly a lot of patients in clinical practice come to the diagnosis of hepatitis C through routine insurance testing, or for a workplace insurance or otherwise.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Paul Clark, a hepatologist and a research fellow at the Duke Clinical Research Institute, about his, I think, important article in the New England Journal of Medicine, Overcoming Barriers to Care for Hepatitis C. And Dr. Clark, we're going to put up, you have some really nice links that you recommend for the Centers for Disease Control?
That's right, that's one of them, yep.
And also perhaps the American Association for the Study of Liver Disease will put up some public information for those. And we're also going to, some of our listeners, perhaps we'll have a little behind the scenes, a chance to explore a few more questions that we couldn't do on the air. But I want to thank you for being our guest, and thank you for putting an article out there that certainly will, I think, help providers and patients and policymakers all really turn their attention more to what we can do to help patients with hepatitis C.
Well, thanks, Adam. Thanks for your time today, and thanks for trying to put the message out.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to talk about several health questions and concerns from listeners, including ones about Una boots.
And also about schizophrenia medicines and about how to soothe a baby on an airplane.
Other than not flying with the baby.
a little bit about immunization schedules.
Like when, what, where, and how.
Exactly.
These are important. We're going the whole spectrum here, from one age group to another. Let's start out with our very first listener question.
My mom recently saw her family doctor and had a uniboot put on her leg. She has lots of swelling and some skin that oozes. I've never heard of this. How long can it stay on her leg? Is there any side effects about it?
Well, an uniboot, now spelled U-N-N-A, is actually a therapeutic
proprietary name product that family doctors and internists have been using for a long time to treat a variety of conditions, including swelling in the leg or what's called chronic venous stasis disease, where the legs swell and sometimes ooze.
And it can really help with the kind of swelling, or you might hear the word edema, weeping and ulcers and things that can happen to the skin of the legs when those veins don't drain properly.
And frequently that'll be put on in your family doctor, your primary care doctor's office, and wrapped. And it, most patients describe this as it actually feels very cooling and soothing. And the nice thing is it can be left on for 5 to 7 days and get significant amounts of swelling and heal up some of those chronic draining ulcers of the leg in the right patient.
And the other thing to consider is that the main thing to do when you have that venous insufficiency or when the veins aren't draining well is to compress those legs, to elevate the legs. There's some exercises you can do, but compression on the legs is very important to help those legs not be so swollen.
Side effects of Una boots. Well, if you have an underlying infection or cellulitis, it wouldn't be the right thing. And then if you maybe have underlying bad diabetes or some sort of condition of your blood vessels that you maybe have problems with in your circulation, you may have to, again, be very careful of that. But these are really well tolerated and perhaps underutilized. Thank you so much for your question. Let's listen to our very next house call.
I have a son with schizophrenia, and he was given a medication by his doctor recently called Geodine, and one before that called Zyprexa. We went to the pharmacy and found out it was going to cost us over $1,000 a month for these medications. We truly cannot afford this expense. We have jobs, but $12,000 a year for one medication seems excessive. What other alternatives do we have?
I am so sorry to hear the disappointing reality that medicines cost a lot of money. And these particular ones, Geodine and Zyprexa, are very expensive. Hearing that how much that is shocking.
Yeah. And, you know, this newer generation of psychiatric medications for schizophrenia, kind of as a class, they're designed to potentially have less side effects, but they are, as a class, 10, 20 times more expensive than the ones they replaced. And that's a real problem as far as I'm concerned, Christy.
There are the first generation antipsychotics, or the medicines like Haldol would be one that comes to mind.
Yeah, generic version of Haldol will cost probably $20 a month compared to $1,000.
I found it for $4 a month. So, I mean, it is extremely cheap. It may have different side effects. Each one of these has different potential side effects. And so you have to work really closely with the doctor to find the right medicine that has it works with the least side effects and the least cost.
And I do think there was some recent research looking at all of the classes and pretty much determining that pretty much they all work about the same. But you're right, there may be some increased incidence or numbers of side effects with some of these. But in terms of how they work, they're pretty equivalent. So I think you should talk with your psychiatrist or your primary care doctor about finding one that works for you that doesn't bankrupt you as a family.
Thank you for your question. Let's take our next house call question.
What can be done to soothe a baby on a flight when dealing with air pressure changes?
Oh, my heart goes out to you. That is one of the worst feelings of being on an airplane and having a baby and wanting the baby to be quiet for everyone and not being able to get the baby quiet. It's hard.
And now that my children are older, Christy, I just hope that I'm sitting as far away from you as possible. No. I'm empathetic and certainly understand. And I would reach out and make some common sense suggestions like...
Well, I would say think about how well you pack, prepare, thinking about timing of when you feed the baby, bringing some distracting toys, bringing whatever it takes, an iPad or video thing or anything that seems to distract the baby.
You're leaving on a jet plane. And don't forget to take your Tylenol or your Advil, your ibuprofen, and some hard candy, assuming the baby's over 3 years old, the child is, or some gum.
And if you've got a breastfeeding or formula-fed baby, doing that during takeoff and during the landing part can help sort of open up those ear passages that sometimes get blocked during that change in pressure.
Or even having some water, something decaffeinated on board to drink on. And keeping that child awake, because if they're awake, they're more likely to swallow than as if they're sleeping and then wake up screaming, and then it's hard.
I'd also say try to try to keep yourself as calm as possible. You were mentioning Advil. I'm like, yeah, you should probably take that for yourself.
No, that'd be some Valium.
Yeah. Just because, you know, your child picks up on your own anxiety, and as much as you can try to be calm and apologize to people if you need to, or show people around you that you're doing the best you can, I've found people are calm and kind.
This too
mostly.
Will pass.
Yes,
we have been there.
It.
I've had three children on those airplanes, and I think each one of them has been crying, hopefully not all at the same time. Been there, done that. We wish you luck. Thank you so much for that question.
Let's take our next house call question.
Are immunization schedules accurate, or are parents that have adapted their child's immunization schedule correct?
Well, what do you think here, Christy? I'm not sure I fully understand this listener's question, but...
I agree. I'm not sure if you mean at first, I thought you meant the schedules that are put out by the CDC of recommendations of when to give them. But then I hear the rest and think this is more about the doctor's office report of when people got their immunizations versus what the parents keep track of.
Yeah. For the most part, I think the doctor's offices are going to be pretty good about this, because we have to, not only does the doctor have to place an order most of the times, then that's recorded, then the nurse has to write down the batch number, and that's recorded, and then they have to write down that they've administered them, then there's billing records. So there's lots of duplication frequently. So a lot of times those doctor's offices will be pretty accurate.
And there's also a state recording system in North Carolina, and so that's another place to get information if you've moved around to different practices. But I do think parents should keep records. On those little sheets that you can carry around, the nurse, you can ask the nurse every time you get shots to enter that information, and that's done in a way that's very reliable. And so I would say do both. Take your own responsibility, but also know that the doctor has office has a lot of different ways to keep it. Straight.
There's also the Centers for Disease Control. It's a really nice website about immunization schedules and vaccine schedules, and they have printable versions if you're doing them in the normal schedule, if you're running behind and you're late on some of those, in Spanish and in English. And we'll ask our resource librarians at the Health Sciences Library if they can put a nice link up about this CDC.gov vaccines website.
It's a wonderful resource. Thank you for giving us questions today, and thanks for all of you for listening and being with us for your health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health, and we want you to write us, share your stories, your comments about the show, ask us questions at yourhealth@unc.edu, or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download on iTunes.
I think I'll do that, Christy. You can also join us next week on Your Health, and we want to thank WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Paul Clark.
And on behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.